Nile sits at the head of the oval table facing his top five project managers. He spreads his bony fingers on the table in front of him. He doesn't know where to start. It's even hard to know how to address the game. There are no version numbers anymore. They've been replaced by continuous upgrades. Mastery Online is now a mammoth, expanding, ever-evolving enterprise. But it's rotten at its core. We have a Midas problem. There's no end game, just a stagnant, pyramiding scheme. Endless, pointless prosperity. The team listens, frowning. They all earn six figures. Most are millionaires. The youngest is 28, the oldest 42. But in their jeans and skateboard tees, their mop tops and skewed baseball caps, they look like simulated teens. Bohm and Robinson kick back, sipping energy drinks and munching trail bars. Nguyen has his feet up on the table and gazes through the window as if it's a virtual reality headset. All five beep and ding, whistle and vibrate, with more prosthetic parts than sci-fi ever dreamed of. How do you win? I mean, how would you even lose? The only thing that really counts is hoarding a little bit more. You reach a certain level in the game, and going on just feels hollow, dirty, more of the same. The man in the wheelchair at the table's head bows and stares into his own grave. The long Sikh-style hair still flows down around his middle, but it's shot through now with a river of white. A beard erupts from his chin and falls like a bib onto his Superman sweatshirt. His arms still have some meat on them, from decades of lifting himself in and out of bed, but his legs, inside their cargo pants, are a little more than vague suggestions. In front of him, on the table, is a book. The elves know what that means. The boss has been reading again. Another visionary idea has taken possession of him. Soon he'll badger them all to read it, in search of solutions to what is a problem only to him. Kaltoff, Rasha, Robinson, Nguyen, Bohm. Five ebullient honors students huddle up in a super-smart war room, equipped with banks of screens and all the electronic conferencing toys tomorrow might need. But today, they can only stare at the boss, slack-jawed. He's saying mastery is broken. A magic, money-printing franchise needs to be rethought. Exasperation threatens to set Kaltoff's mustache on fire. It's a god game, for God's sake! They pay us so they can enjoy a god's problems. We're up to 7 million subscribers, Rasha says. A quarter of them have been playing for a decade. Players are hiring Chinese inmates with web connections to level up their characters while they sleep. The boss does that thing with his eyebrows. If leveling was still fun, they wouldn't have to do that. There might be a problem, Robinson concedes, but it's the same problem we've been dealing with since mastery began. Nile's head bobs up and down, but not in a nod. I wouldn't say dealing. Postponing, maybe. He's grown so gaunt he's set for sainthood. The lip of the sagging Superman sweatshirt reveals his protruding collarbone. He's like one of those ascetic Indian statues, a skin-wrapped skeleton seated under a holy fig or neem. Bohm projects some visuals. Here's what we're thinking. We raise the experience level caps again. We add a bunch of technologies. We call them Future Tech 1, Future Tech 2. They all generate different flavors of prestige points. Then we release another volcanic event out in the middle of the Western Ocean and start a new continent. That sounds like postponing to me. Kaltoff flings up his hands. People want to grow, expand their empires. That's why they pay us every month. The place fills in, we make it a little bigger. There's no other way to run a world.
I see. Lather, rinse, repeat until you die of consummation.
Kaltoff slaps the table. Robinson laughs, giddy. Rasha thinks,
it's just the boss, the guy who writes a million memos a week, the guy who built the company from nothing, exercising his genius right to be wrong.
Which is more interesting, Nile asks. 200 million square miles filled with 100 kinds of biome and 9 million species of living things? Or a handful of flashing colored pixels on a 2D screen?
Nervous laughter around the table. They get which should make the better home, but each one knows his own delight's current mailing address.
Pretty clear where the species is emigrating, boss.
Why? Why give up an endlessly rich place to live in a cartoon map?
It's a little too much philosophy for the boy millionaires, but they humor the man who hired them all. They loosen into the question, listing the glories of symbol space, the cleanness, the speed, the instant feedback, the power and control, the connectivity, the sheer amount of stuff you can amass, the buffs and badges, all the compliant pleasures that light up the whole cortex. They talk about the purity of the game, how it's always going somewhere at a clip that's clearly visible. You can see progress unfold. Effort means something.
Nile nods his refusal again.
Until it doesn't. Until it turns tedious.
The group falls silent. Mass sobriety sets in. Nguyen takes his feet off the table.
People want a better story than they get.
The wild-haired Sadhu leans forward so fast he almost pitches out of his wheelchair.
Yes! And what do all good stories do?
There are no takers. Nile holds up his arms and extends his palms in the oddest gesture. In another moment, leaves will grow from his fingers. Birds will come and nest in them.
They kill you a little. They turn you into something you weren't.
Awareness spreads through them, slow and certain as death. The boss is playing another game now, one that would have no trouble burning their game as fuel.
Bohm asks, what are you saying we should do?
Nile holds up the book like it's divine dictation. They can read the title on the cover, under the rising web of leaves. The Secret Forest.
Robinson groans.
Not more plants, boss. You can't make a game out of plants unless you give them bazookas.
Let's put an atmosphere into the model. Add water quality, nutrient cycles, finite material resources. Let's make prairies and wetlands and forests that capture the richness and complexity of the real deals.
And then what? Bleaching reefs and rising seas and drought-driven wildfires? If that's how people play it. Why on earth? Our players want to get away from all that shit.
The game wants its players. That's the great mystery.
How would you win that?
Kaltoff taunts.
By finding out what works. By pushing the way truth pushes.
You're saying no new continents.
No new continents. No sudden spawning of new mineral deposits. Regeneration only at realistic rates. No rising from the grave. A wrong choice in the game should lead to permadeath.
The elves catch each other's eyes. The boss is out of control. He's willing to crash the franchise, to trash the endless moneymaker that will keep them all in junkets forever, just to solve the problem of too much satisfaction.
How, Nguyen says, how are limits and shortages and permadeath going to be fun? For a moment, the sunken face turns rubbery, and the boss is a little kid again, learning how to program, his code branching outward in all directions. 7 million users will need to discover the rules of a dangerous new place, to learn what the world will bear, how life really works, what it wants from a player in exchange for continuing to play. Now that's a game. A whole new age of exploration. What more adventure could you ask for? Kaltoff says, Better sell your Semper Virens stock then, because every player we have is going to quit. They'll walk. Walk where? There's too much on the line. Most of our players have invested years. They've built up fortunes of in-game worth. They'll figure out how to rehabilitate the place. They'll surprise us. Like they've always done. The elves sit dumbfounded, calculating the fortunes vanishing before their eyes. But the boss is glowing like he hasn't since he fell from his childhood tree. He lifts the book in the air, opens it, and reads, Something marvelous is happening underground. Something we're just starting to learn how to see. He snaps the book shut for dramatic effect. There's nothing out there even remotely like it. We'd be the first. Imagine, a game with the goal of growing the world instead of yourself. The silence thickens with the proposed madness. Kaltoff says, Not broke, boss. Don't fix. I vote no. The skeletal saint goes around the table one by one. Russia? Nguyen? Robinson? Bohm? No, 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 and no. Unanimous palace coup. Nile feels nothing, not even surprise. Semper Virens, with its 5 divisions and countless employees, its massive annual revenues from subscriptions and media, hasn't been under anyone's control for some time. The tens of thousands of fans, posting to online forums, have more control over what happens next than any of the upper brass. Complex adaptive system. A god game that has escaped its god. It's clear to him. The massively parallel online experience will go on, faithful to the tyranny of the place it pretends to escape. And the 63rd richest man in Santa Clara County, founder of Semper Virens, Inc., creator of The Sylvan Prophecies, only child, devotee of distant worlds, lover of Hindi comics, avid fan of all rule-breaking stories, flyer of digital kites, timid cursor of teachers, faller from Coast Live Oaks, learns what it means to be eaten alive by his own insatiable offspring. It's ancient history now, a decade-old story Douglas Pavlicek keeps in his arsenal to spring on unsuspecting summer visitors who wander into the erstwhile whorehouse that serves as the ghost town visitor center. He'll lay it on anyone who holds still long enough to hear. Then I had to crab walk backward, uphill, on my ass, kicking off from tree trunks with my good leg, switchbacked up an 80-foot bluff in the snow, while my dislocated shoulders stabbed me like the Holy Ghost with a hot poker, crawled in and out of consciousness as far as that old silver mine head frame not 100 yards from here, and there I lay, as good as dead for who knows how long. Seeing visions and hearing the forest talk, while wolverines and such probably licked my face for the salts on my skin. By miracle, I reached the office, called in the medevacs, and got a lift to Missoula in a chopper. Felt like I was back in Nam, about to shoot out of my old herky bird and start the whole wheel of eternal return over again. He tells the story a lot, and the tourists mostly put up with it. Then, one evening, 10 minutes after quitting time, he tells it to a woman across the display case who digs it. Youngish, kind of, in bandana and backpack, with a cute-as-hell Eastern European accent, a little ripe-scented, but friendly as a retriever covered with ticks. She's all on the balls of her feet, waiting to hear if he survives or not. Deep into the rising action, he starts improvising a little. Let's face it, there's only so much that the arc of his story will hold. Yet she's eating it up, like he's one of those epileptic Russian novelists, and all she wants is to find out what happens next, and next after that. When the story ends, she watches him close up the office. Outside, in the lot, there's nothing but his white BLM Ford anywhere in sight. All the day's visitors have headed back down the washboard road in their expeditions and pathfinders. The woman, Alena, asks,
"There is some place nearby I can camp, do you think?"
He's been there himself, a long haul with no campsite ahead. He spreads his palms, all the abandoned buildings he's supposed to check and clear each night. No camping allowed, but who's to know?
Take your pick.
She bows her head.
Do you maybe have crackers or something?
It occurs to him that it may not be his storytelling skill that held her saucer-eyed, but he brings her up to the cabin and feeds her. Pulls out all the stops, the rabbit fillet he's been saving for no reason, fried mushrooms and onions, a decent coffee cake made of grape nuts, and a couple of shots of fermented thimbleberry. She tells him about her adventures walking across the Garnet Range.
"We started out 4 people. No idea where those 3 went."
"Kind of dangerous out this way. You shouldn't be out here by yourself, looking like you do."
"How I look?"
She blows a raspberry and whisks her palm.
"Like an ill monkey who needs washing."
She looks to Douglas, good enough to be some mail-order bride scam.
"Really? A young woman by herself? Not a patentable idea."
"Young? Who is that? Besides, this is the greatest country. Americans are the friendliest people in the world. Always want to help. Like you. Look, you made this great meal. You didn't need..."
"You liked it? Really?"
She holds out her glass for more thimbleberry wine.
"Well," he says, when the silence gets weird, even by his standards, "you're welcome to the water from the pump. Take your pick of any building down there. I'd keep out of the barber shop. Something must have died in there recently."
"This house is nice."
"Oh, well, listen, you don't owe me anything. It was just food."
"Who's making a business?"
Then she's straddling his chair, scrutinizing his face, trying it out with her periscope lips. She breaks off.
"Hey, you're crying. Strange man."
There's no good reason why any species would ever have evolved so useless a behavior.
"I'm an old guy."
"You're sure?
Let's see." She tries again. The first woman's flesh to warm his for years. It's like a lockpick scratching around a bunged-up keyhole in his chest. He pins her wrists.
"I don't love you."
"Okay, mister. No problem. I don't love you either."
She tugs at his chin.
"People don't have to love to enjoy."
He gives her back her hands.
"Trust me, they do."
His arms go slack, like they're chained through a pipe to a concrete slab buried in the ground.
"Okay,"
she says again, sullen. She pushes against his chest and stands.
"You are a sad little mammal."
"I am that."
He stands and brings the remains of the feast to the basin.
"You take the bed. I'll sleep in the bag out here. The facilities are in the yard. Careful of the stinging nettle."
The sight of the bed thrills her. American Christmas.
You are a good old guy.
Not especially. He shows her how to work the lantern. Lying on the floor in the front room, he sees the light under the door. Someone's reading late. He doesn't realize until later just what she's reading. In the morning, there's more grape nut coffee cake and actual coffee. No further adventures in cross-cultural misunderstanding. She leaves before the first tourists come up the mountain. Soon enough, the visitor isn't even a story he tells himself at night to feed his regrets and beat up on himself for nostalgia. But America, it turns out, really is the greatest country. The people are so kind. The land is rich beyond imagining, and the authorities will cut a deal for useful information, even after booking you for multiple crimes. In 2 more months, when the men with the initials on their jackets make their way up the mountain, Douglas has all but forgotten his overnight guest. Not until the Freddies pin him in the driveway, tear up the cabin and remove his handwritten journal in a sealed plastic box, does he remember her. He fights to keep from smiling as they hogtie him and get him into the government land cruiser. You think this is funny? No. No, of course not. Well, maybe a little. It has all happened before, and as far as Douglas Pavlicek can make out, it will keep happening forever. Prisoner 571, reporting for duty, 4 decades on. They don't ask him much. They don't have to. He has written it all down in painstaking detail in a nightly ritual of memory and explanation. Signed, sealed, delivered. All the crimes the 5 of them committed. Maidenhair, Watchman, Mulberry, Doug Fir, and Maple. But it's a funny thing. His captors aren't all that interested in forest names. Dorothy shows up in the doorway, the eternally recurring breakfast tray in her arms.
Morning, Ray Ray. Hungry?
He's awake, tranquil, looking out through the window onto the acre and a half of Brinkman land. He has grown so calm these days. There have been stretches, terrible days, that she was sure would kill him. Last winter was the worst. One February afternoon, she spent minutes trying to hear what he was wailing. When she finally made him out, it was as if he were reading her mind. I'm done. It's hemlock time. But spring brought him back to himself, and in these days near the summer solstice, she'd swear she has never seen him happier. She puts the tray down on the bedside table.
How about some peach banana cobbler?
He tries to raise his hand, perhaps to point, but the hand has other ideas. When he at last gets his mouth to work, he comes at her out of the blue.
There. That.
The words slur, as pulpy as the hot fruit mush she has made for breakfast. He leads with his eyes.
That. True.
She looks out, her features eager, trying to pretend that the request makes perfect sense. Still the consummate amateur thespian.
Yes?
His mouth opens and he launches a syllable midway between what and who. Her voice stays bright.
What kind? Ray, you know I'm hopeless at that. Some evergreen?
From when?
2 words, like biking uphill on a muddy mountain trail. She gazes at the tree as if she has never laid eyes on it.
Good question.
For a moment, she can't remember how long they've lived in this place or what they've planted. He flails a little, but not in distress.
Let's see.
Then she's standing in front of a wall of books. Ceiling to floor, their lifetime hoard of print. She puts her palm on a shoulder-high shelf, wood she can't name. Her finger flicks the dusty spines, looking for a thing she's not sure is there. The past tries to kill her, all the people they were or had hoped to be. She skips by 100 hikes in the Yellowstone. She pauses on a field guide to eastern songbirds as something bright and red in her head flies off, unidentified. The slender thing, almost a pamphlet, skulks near the end of the shelf. Easy Tree IDs. She takes down the book. An inscription on the title page ambushes her. For my dear first dimension, my sole and only dot. Care to see which trees are clear and which are clearly not? She has never seen the words before, not even a vague memory of any attempt to learn the names of trees together. But the poem brings back the poet intact. The best, worst poet in the world. She flips the pages. Way more oaks than good taste would recommend. Red, yellow, white, black, gray, scarlet, iron, live, burr, valley, and water, with leaves that deny all relation to each other. She remembers now why she never had the patience for nature. No drama, no development, no colliding hopes and fears. Branching, tangled, messy plots. And she could never keep the characters straight. She reads the inscription again. How old was the jingle writer? Best worst poet. Best worst actor. Patent and copyright lawyer who drove cheats into bankruptcy, then spent a tenth of each year doing pro bono. He wanted a large family for the all-night Crazy Eights marathons and the four-part novelty songs on long car trips. Instead, it was only him and his dear first dimension. She carries the booklet back to his room. Ray, look what I found! The howling mask of his face seems almost pleased. When did you give this to me? Nice we held on to it, huh? Just what we need now. Ready? He's worse than ready. He's a kid on his way to camp. Start here. If you live east of the Rocky Mountains, go to entry 1. If you live west of the Rocky Mountains, go to entry 116. She looks at him. His eyes are damp, but traveling. If your tree produces cones and has needle-like leaves, go to entry 11C. They both look out the window, as if the answer hasn't been staring at them for the last quarter century. In the noonday light, the world bows, stout and layered at wide intervals, shine a funny bluish silver she has never noticed. The tapered, narrow spire shimmers in the overhead sun. Definite yes on the needles. Cones up top, too. Raymond, I believe we may be on to something. She flips through the pages to the treasure hunt's next way station. Are the needles evergreen and arranged in sheathed bundles of 2 to 5 needles each? If yes, go to... She looks up. His mask smirks now, more than it should be able to. The eyes are alight. Adventure. Excitement. Goodbye. Travel well. Be right back. The smallest packet of surprise lodges at the top of her chest. Like that, she's off. She retreats through the kitchen into the back pantry, a warren of cubbies cluttered with decades of set it and forget it. Some weekend she'll sort through the ancient junk, pitch it all, lighten the lifeboat for the last few nautical miles. The back door opens, and she smells the waves of grassy summer rolling over her. She has no shoes. The neighbors will think she has lost her mind caring for her brain-damaged husband. And if she has, well then, that's the story. She crosses the lawn, takes the lowest branch in her hand, bends it toward her, and counts. There's a song about this, she thinks, a song or a prayer, or a story, or a film. The branch slips upward from her hand. She drifts back to the house over the sun-ghosted grass. humming the tune that is about exactly this moment. He's waiting for her, hanging on the denouement. 5 in a sheath. We're on a roll. She flips through the book to the next unfolding branch. Are the cones long with thin scales? This splitting and choosing, she recognizes it. It's like the law. Those cases she transcribed during all those years when she played a court stenographer. The evidence, the cross-examinations, messy negotiations and manufactured facts, the path narrowing in on a sole-allowable verdict. It's like evolution's decision tree. If the winters are tough and the waters scarce, try scales or needles. It's even, weirdly, like acting. If you need to respond with fear, go to gesture 21C. If wonder, 17A. Otherwise, it's a programmed telephone support system for living on Earth. It's the mind moving through mysteries, their explanations forever one more choice away. More than anything, it's like the tree itself, with one central questioning stem splitting into dozens of probing ones, and each of those forking into hundreds, then thousands of green and independent answers. Stay tuned, Dorothy says, and disappears again. Once more, the back door's black enamel knob protests, squeaking in her hand. She makes her way across the yard to the tree. A short journey, repeated ad nauseam more times than anyone ever signs on for, across the same patch of familiar ground. The path of love. If you want to keep fighting, turn to entry 1001. If you want to break loose and save yourself... She stands under the tree and studies the cones. They cover the ground, spores that crash to Earth from some remote asteroid. Then back to the house with her answer. The way across the wet grass and stocking feet is long enough for her to wonder how she can still be here, buried alive, tied to this frozen man year after year, when all she ever wanted in this life was to find her freedom. But back in the prison doorway, waving the book in triumph, she knows. This is her freedom. This one. The freedom to be equal to the terrors of the day. Victory! Eastern white pine! She'd swear a great wave of contentment sweeps across the rigid face. She can read him now, with a telepathy honed by years of having to guess at his clotted syllables. He's thinking, a good day's work, a very good day. That night he makes her read to him about a tree that once ran in great vertical veins of living ore from Georgia to Newfoundland, out through Canada, and past the Great Lakes to where they camp out together by lamplight. She tells him about giants 4 feet wide, their trunks shooting 80 feet straight up before the first sideways branches bothered to extend. Trees that stood in endless stands that darkened the air with pollen each spring, the clouds of golden dust raining down on the decks of ships far out at sea. She reads to him of how the English first swarmed a continent that rose from the ocean overnight, seeking masts for their leviathan frigates and ships of the line, masts that no place in all stripped Europe, not even the farthest boreal north, could any longer provide. She shows him paintings of Pinus strobus, in hulking shafts as big as church steeples, so valuable that the crown branded even those that stood on private land with the king's broad arrow. And her husband, who spent his life protecting private property, must see it coming, even from the future, the Pine Tree Riot. Revolution. War, fought over a thing that grew on these shores long before humans came down out of trees. It's a story to match any fiction. The well-wooded land, succumbing to prosperity. the light, soft, strong, dimensioned boards, sold back across the ocean as far away as Africa. The triangular profit making the infant country's fortune. Lumber to the Guinea coast, black bodies to the Indies, sugar and rum back up to New England, with its stately mansions all built of eastern white pine. White pine framing out cities, making millions in sawmill fortunes, laying a bed of rails across the continent, building and pitching warships and whaling fleets that wander out from Brooklyn and New Bedford into the unmapped South Pacific, ships made of 1,000 trees or more. The white pines of Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota split into 100 billion roof shingles, 100 million board feet a year, splintered into matchsticks. Scandinavian lumberjacks clearing a swath of pine 3 states wide, wrestling the colossal husks into rivers with tackle and boom, riding miles-long rafts of them downstream to market. A giant hero and his big blue ox cutting the pine to clear the Brinkman's neighborhood. Dorothy reads, and the wind picks up. All the yard bends with complaint. Rain blows in. The small room grows smaller still. Night. The third part of every day that remains a foreign country. The house next door vanishes, and the ones just north of that, until the Brinkmans huddle up alone, out on the edge of a savage wilderness. Ray's working leg thrashes against the sheets that hem him in. All he ever wanted was to earn an honest living, promote the general welfare, earn the respect of his community, and raise a decent family. Wealth needs fences. But fences need wood. Nothing left on the continent even hints at what has gone. All replaced now by thousands of miles of continuous backyards and farms with thin lines of second growth between them. Still, the soil remembers for a little while longer the vanished woods and the progress that unmade them. And the soil's memory feeds their backyard pine. Spittle wells on Ray's trembling lips. It stays there until Dorothy wipes it off, sometime before midnight. The lips move as she wipes them. She leans in and thinks she hears him whisper, "One more. Tomorrow." The night is warm. The windows of Patricia's cabin bang in the breeze, and the sturgeon moon rises over the lake like a pale red penny. She rests her palms on the stack of notebooks filled with her careful hand. "Well, then, I believe we may finally be done." There's no answer tonight, as there never is. The words do no more than hang in the air. Plenty of creatures here. Inside the cabin and out. Her syllables answer and change the various chirps, groans, sighs, plans, and estimates that punctuate this night. The conversation is long, patient, beyond any party's ability to follow, and the patterned noises her kind add to it are still brand new. She listens for a moment to the hour's alarms. Then she pushes down against the walnut table. Her legs straighten, and she rises. She flips open the uppermost notebook to the page where she has just written, "In a world of perfect utility, we too will be forced to vanish." "You're sure this is a good idea?" she asks herself. She asks the dead man. The membrane between the two is thin. She knows she'll never see him again in this or any life to come, yet she sees him wherever she looks. That's life. The dead keep the living alive. Every other night she asks her missing friend for words and phrases, for courage, for enough forbearance to keep from pitching her notes into the wood-burning stove. Now, the asking is done. She flips the page. No one sees trees. We see fruit, we see nuts, we see wood, we see shade. We see ornaments or pretty fall foliage. Obstacles blocking the road or wrecking the ski slope. Dark, threatening places that must be cleared. We see branches about to crush our roof. We see a cash crop. But trees, trees are invisible.
It's not bad, then. A little bleak, maybe.
Short, too, she might add. Far smaller than her firstborn. There's so much more to tell, but she's an old woman now, without much time, and there are so many more species still to find and take aboard the Ark. The book is a simple enough story. She could have told it in a page or two, how she and several others spent years traveling to all the continents but Antarctica, how they saved a few seeds from a few thousand trees, a fraction of the species that will vanish as the Earth's current custodians watch, bringing countless dependents down with them. She has tried to hold out hope, to tell every story that might make the truth a little easier. She gives a whole chapter to migration. She describes all the trees already marching north at rates that astonish those who measure them. But the most vulnerable trees will need to move much faster to keep from burning up. They can't cross highways or farms or housing developments. Maybe we can help them. She spins short biographies of her favorite characters, loner trees, cunning trees, sages and solid citizens, trees that turn impulsive or shy or generous, as many ways of being as there are forest elevations and facings. How fine it would be if we could learn who they are, when they're at their best. She tries to turn the story on its head. This is not our world with trees in it. It's a world of trees where humans have just arrived. One passage keeps springing back, every time fear or scientific rigor makes her prune it. Trees know when we're close by. The chemistry of their roots and the perfumes their leaves pump out change when we're near. When you feel good after a walk in the woods, it may be that certain species are bribing you. So many wonder drugs have come from trees, and we haven't yet scratched the surface of the offerings. Trees have long been trying to reach us, but they speak on frequencies too low for people to hear. She's up from the table with a groan meant for no one. In the front closet, she finds the stack of nested cardboard boxes that she and Dennis always had such trouble throwing out. Moldy boxes, saved for decades. Who knows when you might need one exactly this size? The notebooks fit, as if by design. She'll mail them to an assistant tomorrow for typing. Then to her editor in New York, who has been waiting for years for a follow-up to a book that's still in print, still selling, still weighing on Patricia's conscience for its cost in pines. As soon as she seals the carton with packing tape, she cracks it open again. The last line of the last chapter is still wrong. She looks at what she has, although the sentence has long since burned itself into permanent memory. With luck, some of those seeds will remain viable, inside controlled vaults in the side of a Colorado mountain, until the day when watchful people can return them to the ground. She purses her lips and pens an addendum. If not, other experiments will go on running themselves long after people are gone.
That's probably better, she says out loud. Right?
But the ghost has finished dictating tonight. When the box is set to go, she gets ready for bed. Ablutions are quick and grooming even faster. Then the reading, her nightly 1,000-mile walk to the Gulf. When her eyes won't stay open any longer, she finishes with verse. Tonight's poem is Chinese. Wang Wei, 1,200 years old, from an anthology of poetry she winds through at random, the way she likes to hike. I know no good way to live, and I can't stop getting lost in my thoughts, my ancient forests. You ask, how does a man rise or fall in this life? The fisherman's song flows deep under the river. Then the river is running over her, and she's done. She douses the dim low-watt bulb clipped to the headboard. All that's left her is the moon. She rolls on her side and curls up, her face pressed into the dank pillow. After a minute, the end of her mouth pulls into an abiding smile.
I did not almost forget. Good night.
Good night.